trackers who were less than friendly. Alec had seen the thigh-high robotic animals tear a human to shreds, and that was after they'd unleashed 20 rounds of high-caliber bullets into him. He waited, hoping it was just a random patrol seeker and not the overseers seriously searching for him. He found an open window across the room, stuck his head beneath it, and listened for signs of a seeker. There was the whining noise, but it was fleeting, disappearing as the drones moved on. He sat on the concrete floor and rested against the hard wall as he tried to convince his heart to calm down. He couldn't keep doing this. The next time would probably be his last. Waiting another 5 minutes for good measure, Alec eventually tiptoed outside, and when he saw or heard no sign of the overseer's creations, he ran along the building, careful to stay in the dark shadows as long as he could. It took twice as long to return to his bunk as leaving had, but he made it, and with only 4 hours before his shift in the plant started. He fell to the thin mattress, not bothering to change his clothes. Even after his exciting night, he found sleep after only a few deep breaths. 3 new workers arrived at the plant on his shift the next day. They were the hardened faces of people that had been through it all but still kept working endlessly. Alec tried not to stare, but it was difficult. They hadn't brought any new blood to the site for at least 5 months, and the ones Alec worked with were either too brash or too meek to survive much longer. The group stuck together, and Simon had them working on the far left corner of the contraption they were building. The sweaty, bald man made eye contact with Alec, forcing Alec to quickly look away. He wasn't going to give the man an excuse to be riled up today.
"Bring the sheet, I'm ready,"
Darnell said without averting his stare from the metal-walled structure. Alec hefted it up and pressed it in place, glad to have gloves on as the solder began to drip beside him. By the time the siren sounded, Alec was exhausted and wanted to sit and eat their meager dinner with Beth. The newcomers ambled over and arrived in line behind Alec. The man at his back was a big guy, 6'2", at least 240. His head was shaved, like everyone else's, but on him, it looked natural, like he would choose it anyway. Dark stubble covered his cheeks and skin.
"Hey, name's Crash. These are my friends, Monet and Jackfish."
He motioned to a tough woman. Piercing dark brown eyes met his, and she smiled, showcasing sparkling white teeth. Jackfish was a skinny kid, probably only 20, and his eyes darted around like he was afraid something was coming for him.
"Nice to meet you. I'm Alec," he said, moving ahead in line.
"Where are you from? Haven't seen you before."
"Just got in. They brought us over from Denver. Guess they liked our work."
Crash said this with a chuckle, and the others laughed with him, leaving Alec out of some sort of inside joke.
"Sure, guess so."
Alec turned and saw it was his turn. He stuck a palm out, getting a full dinner chit, and kept moving. When they were in line for dinner, the big man moved close to him, so close he could feel the hot breath on his ear.
"We know who you are. We're friends of Tom's."
Then just like that, the man had turned and was speaking quietly with Monet. Alec's heart was racing as he tried to understand the words. Tom? How could they be friends of Tom's? And Denver? That was a long way away from Detroit. He'd never heard of anyone being transferred that far.
"Next,"
the usual woman said, piling his gruel in the center of the white bowl and shoving it toward Alec. "Thank you." He tried to smile, but the corners of his mouth twitched nervously. He put his head down and glanced at Crash, who was doing his best to ignore him. It was clear he shouldn't eat with them tonight, and he kept moving, seeing Beth by herself at the table. She worked in a different part of the old car manufacturing plant, one that always let its workers out a few minutes earlier than Alec's crew. "Hey, Beth," Alec said. She peered up from her plate, her eyes half closed.
"Is everything okay?" I don't think so. I haven't been feeling well, and they won't do anything for me. I caused a bit of a scene today and got a half chit.
She nodded to the tiny portion of food on her plate. Without thinking, he grabbed her plate and swapped it with his. She tried to switch them, checking to see if anyone had noticed his rule breaking.
Just eat it, Beth.
You had a half serving last night. You need the food,
Beth said quietly.
Don't worry about me.
Alec scooped up the gruel, eating quickly as he watched the three new workers join another pair at an empty table. Crash glanced at him, then averted his eyes.
Who are they?
Beth asked.
No one.
Alec had to find a way to talk to Crash. Alone.
What's bothering you? Stomach again?
Alec asked.
Stomach? Nothing new,
she answered, her head hanging low as she ate the food. Her right arm circled around the plate protectively. It wasn't unusual for his friend to feel unwell, and they never did anything about it. Occasionally, they'd inject a sick person with a shot, but Alec had no idea what it was. Could be something to help, or perhaps make them worse. Alec didn't think the overseers cared much for sick workers. He'd seen more than one person with a lingering cough pulled away from the job site, never to return. Alec didn't think they were visiting a farm upstate. He wasn't naive. Not anymore. He'd seen friends disappear. People killed on the job site for minor infractions, and worst of all, Tom had left him there alone.
Try to get a shot, some medicine.
Talk to your site supervisor tomorrow, or someone on his team that seems a little more sympathetic. These are humans, after all. Alec hoped one of them would help Beth. Even though they were people, the ones working directly for the aliens seemed to have forgotten that. The workers, the slaves, were nothing more than animals to them. He didn't understand how they could do that to their own kind.
I will.
The siren rang, the lights flashing to indicate their short mealtime was finished. Back to the bunks. Alec stayed there as long as he could, getting into the rear of the line. Beth was ahead near the front, and he noticed her plodding steps. She'd given up. If he didn't help her escape soon, she was going to end up dead. Crash and his friends were four people ahead, and Alec tried not to stare at them. He glanced at the big man's hand, seeing a piece of paper flash out from his palm and then back into his grip. Had that been a signal? The line moved through the cafeteria, past the entrance to the job sites and outside into a rainy night. The wind was calm, the fat drops of precipitation falling straight to the ground, and in a matter of seconds, Alec was drenched. The line moved slowly, a depressing march to their row of bunks. He watched as they neared the line of metal-walled units, each with a number painted in white digits. Something fell from the newcomer's hand, and the four people in front of Alec stepped by it, not noticing. Alec bent low, swiftly picking up the paper, and without looking at it, he shoved it deep into his pocket. Crash turned at Unit 7, and the three headed to a different hall than Alec's. His heart was beating so fast he thought someone was going to hear it, and when lightning flashed in the distant, open sky, Alec jumped with it. Eventually, he made his way to his unit, a small metal door with a much smaller, barred window. He arrived inside, no guards nearby, and he wished he could lock it. No one had ever come into his room, his cell, but he still worried. Alec pressed his back against the door, knowing he'd at least be alerted if someone tried to enter. He waited until he heard no more shuffling or feet from the hall, and finally, he stuck his hand into his pocket, pulling out the wet piece of paper. Alec wiped the note against his coveralls before unfolding it. Hand off at 11 sharp tomorrow. Go to McCook, Nebraska. That was it. No names, no other directions. McCook, N.E., Nebraska. His heart was hammering in his chest, and Alec heard heavy footsteps clanging down the hall's floors. Without a second thought, he tore the note in four and shoved the pieces of wet paper into his mouth, chewing quickly and swallowed the evidence.
He sat on his bed and closed his eyes, trying to picture Nebraska on a map. It was somewhere west of Detroit, that much he knew. Tomorrow, his life was going to change. 7. Lena. They traveled as far north as they could until the cover of the trees ran out. There were 6 of them, ranging from twice her age to half of it. Yet in spite of the fact that Lena was by no means the elder in the group, they all looked to her for guidance.
"We can't go on any further,"
one of them moaned in a voice far too loud for her liking.
"The children can't keep up."
Lena peered at the youngsters, seeing confusion on the face of one of them. They seemed to be coping with the pace over the rough ground just fine. It was the adult who was struggling. She watched through a narrow gap in the treetops, making a judgment call.
"We keep going until we find water," Lena declared. "Then we stop for the day."
Barely half a mile later, their path crossed a bubbling brook running down a mountainside toward the lakes in the valley where they'd lived. They drank, washed their faces and hands, and settled for another uncomfortable night on the damp forest floor and whatever small amount of food they'd either brought or found along the way. Lena had nothing other than a handful of berries she'd seen earlier in the day. They weren't quite ripe enough and had started a twisting, nagging cramp in her stomach after she ate them. One of the children, a boy of perhaps 12, the son of the man complaining about the exertion, sat beside her and held out a piece of dried meat. She smiled, whispering to him that he should eat it himself.
"I took it from my father,"
he said, nodding at the man trying to light a fire without much success, but refusing to allow anyone to help him.
"He always keeps double for himself."
Lena was annoyed on principle, feeling that a parent should go without so that their child should have more. She took the tough meat and chewed it, thanking the smiling boy who slunk away to watch his father fail to light a fire.
"Keep it small,"
Lena reminded them.
"We don't want them to be able to find us."
"I know what I'm doing," snapped the man as he rounded on her. "The trees will cover us."
Lena bit back her answer, knowing that he would never agree with anyone but himself. That was the kind of man he was. The sharp twist in her gut doubled her over in sudden pain. She stood, mumbling her excuses to the others nearby and scrambling almost desperately down the slope beside the stream until she couldn't hear or sense the presence of any others. As she crouched to relieve herself, she slipped and fell into the flowing brook. As the icy water ran around her, she finally felt the stress and loss hit her hard. She sobbed uncontrollably, rolling out of the water with her soaked pants clinging to her, and cried long and hard until all of her energy was sapped by it. She shivered, face blank and emotionless, as her eyes stared without focus. Slowly, as her senses returned to her, she stripped off her clothes, wringing moisture from them, before methodically placing them back on her exhausted body. A sharp whine, moving faster than any insect she had ever heard, zipped above the treetops. Suddenly alert, all sensation of exhaustion and cold forgotten, she set off, returning up the rocky slope of the stream, desperately trying to reach the others and warn them. A bark echoed all around her like 2 pieces of heavy metal hitting one another to produce an almost musical sound. It was answered by another further away, but the echoes seemed to be singing a terrifying duet. A scream, loud and guttural, sounded close, and Lena, to her eternal shame, turned and ran in terror. She broke through the trees during the night, feeling the wind whip past her face so forcefully and suddenly that it made her stop in fright. She panicked, wasting valuable time in the open where she could be seen. She ran in the first direction she chose, following a gentle slope downhill and stumbling as she ran, tripping on tufts of stiff grass covering the uneven, rocky ground. She didn't know how far she had traveled by the time day began to break, but her terror at being out in the world beyond her valley drove her onwards toward a smudge of distant gray on the horizon. When she reached it, she found a broken-down strip of stores with heavy boards rotted away from the smashed windows they'd once covered. She crawled inside the first one she could fit into and sat under a long counter to hug her knees, and then cried until she finally succumbed to exhaustion. Lena woke, breath coming fast and her heart beating fit to burst clean out of her chest. She jerked to life, banging her head on the underside of the counter, forgetting where she was for a few terrifying seconds. When the memory of the last few days hit her, her mind and body gave out so that even fresh tears would not come. She crawled from her hiding spot, stiff muscles cramped and stretching painfully as she stood to her full height. She slid the pack from her chafed shoulders, having been too delirious with fear and tiredness to remove it before, and took stock of herself. She had no food. She had water for another 2 days, at most. She was wearing dirty clothes, which had dried stiff and rubbed her skin, painfully. She still had her pack of medical supplies and a small knife. Lena wouldn't let herself think about her people she'd left behind. There was no helping them, not when the metal creatures arrived.
Water,
she told herself through numb, cracked lips.
Water, food, shelter, fire.
She recited the four basics of survival, somewhat interchangeable depending on her environment, and decided to change the order.
Water, food, fire, she muttered. I have shelter.
But she realized that she knew little about hunting or trapping, and without a safe and plentiful lake to fish in, she didn't know where to find food, especially not in an environment as alien as she found herself now, all alone and without guidance or help. A life spent in a close community, sheltered from the outside world, meant that she knew very little about the remains of the lives she saw all around her. Those lives from before their arrival, from before the occupation, before the wars that made humanity an endangered species. She wandered around the dusty interior of the place, running her hands along the wondrous constructions she'd never seen before. A large machine sat on a counter with pipes and spouts of bright metal beneath the layer of grime and dust, which fell away to her light touch. She had no idea what it was, but the stack of dust-covered cups beside it made her think that it made drinks for the people of the old world instead of them having to boil their own water over a fire. She marveled at it, turning a full circle to take in the other details of the gloomy interior. She stepped closer to the walls to wipe away the layer of filth and expose pictures of what she'd seen in the old magazines. There were cars, motorcycles, airplanes, pictures of men and women dancing together, wearing clothes of bright colors. A word tickled her memory from a story she'd been told years before by one of the elders. She'd used a word to describe a place like that, saying it was where she and her friends would sit and drink something called a soda, until boys came in to do the same. They wouldn't talk, but they would sit apart and send each other messages on things called cell phones. She had called the place a diner. A noise made her creep towards a gap between two boards still in place over the windows. Outside were the rusted hulks of two vehicles with no tires, making them look sad and incomplete. She tried to hold her breath to hear better, but her pounding heart drowned out any noise from outside until movement through the crack caught her eye. She gasped as her gaze caught the source of her alarm and held her breath as a small dog-like creature froze to stare in her direction. The two of them held a motionless competition until the dog loped away, looking as though it used as little energy as possible to move. Releasing her breath and allowing her chest to heave, Lena gathered herself to search the diner for anything she could use. She found big cans that appeared to be food, only when she tried to rub the years of dirt off to read the labels, they crumbled away to leave her without a clue of the contents. Deciding to risk it out of desperation, she used her knife to pry open the edge of the lid of one. It popped open, hitting her with an unpleasant wave of dry air that held hints of both rotten and stale odors. She replaced the lid quickly without looking at the desiccated contents, coughing to clear the smell from her nose, and looked at the shelves again to try and find a different kind of can. She found one, taking it, and instead of rubbing it, she tried to blow the dust off without much success. She turned the can over in her hands and thought she could make out a few letters, one of which was a capital M, and figured that the worst that could happen was another repeat of the last can. She set it to the side, using her knife to level it open as she had before, and this time, the smell that hit her wasn't as unpleasant. She peeked at the clumpy powder inside, risking licking her fingertip to poke it, getting a thin layer of the creamy white dust on her digit. She shrugged to herself, thinking that she couldn't do much worse than she had with the berries, and sucked the fingertip clean. She rolled it across her tongue, smacking her lips together as her face twisted into a mask of confusion with a hint of revulsion.
Milk?
Lena said out loud, unsure why anything in powder form would taste like the milk from goats and cattle. A noise from outside made her freeze. The unmistakable sound of footsteps over broken glass was loud in the small stockroom she was in. She inched towards the door with her knife in hand. Reaching the double doors to the main part of the building, she peered through the surviving glass in them and froze. The dog was shaggy brown with different shaded patches on its fur. It stood in the diner and lifted its head to sniff the air. Movement behind it made her stifle a gasp of fear as another smaller one followed it inside. Coyotes, only bigger and bolder than any she had ever seen. They had never come close to the village in the valley, always kept away by their fires and their weapons, but these animals had probably never seen a person. That would make them bold. They'd have no reason to be scared of humans, to fear her, and she had just walked into their territory. Not wanting to end up torn apart by hungry predators, she edged away and fell into a door at the rear of the building. The strange bar across it gave way under her body weight, and she spilled out into the sunlight at the rear of the diner. Hitting the ground hard, she leapt to her feet, knife held tightly in her grip, fearing an attack. She turned and ran. 8. Dex. A whole damn day. He'd spent an entire day searching for Trent James with no prize at the bottom of the cereal box. He'd seen signs of the man's travels early on, bloodstains on the asphalt parking lot behind the arena that led to a copse of trees. The man was desperate enough to saw his hand off with a sharpened skate, and he was smart enough not to walk down the road in open sight. Dex spent the dark hours of the night driving through all major routes out of Creston, slowly and without lights. He spotted seekers hovering above a few times. They seemed to be having no more luck than he was. Now, as evening came upon him once again, Dex wished he was still cruising around in his car. Trent James had at least a 3-day head start, and he could have trudged away in any direction. Dex had found evidence of him an hour or so after beginning his walk into the trees behind Creston, and every so often he found a fresh set of shoe prints in the damp forest floor. He was on the right track, he knew that much, but he wasn't prepared for an extended excursion. His emergency pack was strapped to his back, but it only held extra food, water, and ammo, not a tent. Now, hours from town, he was looking at the prospect of a night in the woods. A bird chirped, and Dex glanced up, sweating in the evening air. He wore his leather jacket, refusing to pull it off. It was preventing his arms from getting scratched in the trees, and it also kept some of his supplies tucked away. The sun was starting to descend beyond the horizon when Dex's tired legs stopped. He heard water running nearby. Where there was water, there was life. He crept quietly toward the sound and found what he was looking for. A body lay partially hidden in the grass. Dex pulled a scope from his pocket and focused it, seeing a balding, large man on his back. He saw a hand, then looked to the other arm, which ended in a bundle of bloody cloth. Dex chewed his toothpick and grinned. 5 for 5. A week of R&R was just what the doctor ordered. He pulled the Glock out and stepped forward, landing on a twig that broke with an audible snap, and the man shot up to a sitting position. The sudden movement surprised Dex, and he stumbled, his foot catching on an exposed tree root. The whine of a seeker hummed over the canopy of treetops, and Dex glanced up in the waning dusk to see a glint of remaining sunlight reflecting off the drone's shiny body.
"No way, this one's mine," he shouted,
not even sure if the drones responded to their speech. He ran toward the startled man who was trying but failing to heave himself up to his feet. James fell forward, his large body splashing into the shallow creek. The seeker had lowered through the trees and now hovered yards above the flailing roamer.
"Stop! This one is mine," Dex repeated, slowing his words.
He could almost feel the seeker scan his body and turn its attention to the man in the water. He'd stopped thrashing and was sedentary in the creek, water flowing over his lap. He was muttering something, and Dex briefly considered shooting the man in the head. The seeker drone stayed where it was, and Dex cringed. He knew exactly what it was doing. It was sending for a tracker, and that was when things would become serious. Dex checked his location on his clunky tablet. Even at optimal speed, he wasn't getting to his car for 4 hours, and by the look of the man sitting in the water at that moment, it would take a lot longer than that. "Get up," he said. The man seemed amazed that Dex had spoken to him.
"I said up."
Dex leveled his gun at the man's head, and now James finally arrived to his feet. He wore broken glasses, taped together on the bridge, and one of the lenses was cracked, glass spiderwebbed across the lower half.
"Who are you?"
he asked. Most humans had heard of the hunters, but not all of them. From the brief glance of this man's file, he had come from a small arms plant outside Cleveland.
"Name doesn't matter. I'm here to bring you in, hand or no hand. They want you," Dex said.
"Can't you just kill me?"
James asked, glancing nervously up at the drone, hovering in the air above them. Dex was surprised by the man's request. Most of the time, the roamers were cowards. A man prepared to die to escape the overseers? Well, that was a man Dex might grow to respect. But there wasn't time for that now. He shook his head.
"You see that drone?"
The man placed soggy feet onto the firm ground. Each step made a squelching sound. He nodded.
"He's sending out a beacon to his buddies. They're called trackers. They're about yay high."
Dex lowered a hand to somewhere in the middle of his thigh.
"They're mean SOBs. Carry enough ammo on their little bodies to tear through 20 guys your size, but they don't stop there. They'll rip you to shreds. And if you had an ID tag still, that would be all anyone would have to identify your body by. In your case, you'll become a splatter in the forest. Parts of you will float down this creek, other parts will stay here, decaying into the earth."
Trent James swallowed hard and clutched his cloth-covered stump.
"Just kill me,"
he pleaded.
"Too bad, amigo. We're going now, and we have to hurry."
Sometimes Dex tried to befriend the targets to let them think he might switch sides and help them. He wasn't sure if this was going to be one of those times. He didn't have the patience to play games right now, and was glad to see the roamer walk forward. Dex glanced up at the seeker and started to move quickly, happy to see James keeping a good pace. He peered over his shoulder and saw the drone was following at a distance. He only hoped they could return to the car before the trackers intercepted them. They moved quicker than anticipated at first, but after 40 minutes, the large target slowed dramatically. He wheezed and coughed, making enough noise for a tracker to find them from a mile away.
"Will you cut that shit out?"
Dex begged, but it didn't do anything.
"Asthma,"
James said, patting his pocket as if he expected to find an inhaler. The guy was a hot mess and was lucky to have made it this long in the factories. Dex hated talking to the targets, but he was bored and also anxious they were going to be cut off before they got to his car.
"Why did you run?"
he asked without malice. The man didn't answer at first, and when Dex was about to resign himself to another 2 hours of silence, he spoke.
They needed me. I could see it. I kept track of supplies, logistics, and all of that. What moves in and out of each factory, and I chose the right locations to warehouse goods. Food, clothing, weapons, chits, tools. I was the guy that created the software for them.
James was still wheezing, but the talking seemed to help.
I thought you were an accountant or an auditor or something,
Dex said.
I am. I was. But I also minored in the supply chain back in the day,
James said. And Dex squinted at the man. He didn't think he could be over 40.
How old are you?
Dex asked him, and the man shrugged. It must have been in his file, but Dex hadn't read that far.
I haven't thought about that in a long time. It's been 25 years, right?
He asked. Dex nodded.
Then I'm 46, or close. I graduated at 21, hadn't even started in the workforce.
James looked in the distance, his eyes glossing over as they trudged through the cops. Dex thought about his own age. Was he 40 now? He had to be.
So how did you become in charge of logistics for the overseers?
James had piqued Dex's interest. There might be more to this roamer than he'd initially thought. James stumbled, and Dex stuck out an arm, catching him. His skin was pale and slick with sweat.
Before you answer, hold on for a moment.
Dex pulled something from one of his jacket's many pockets.
Nanites?
James asked, his roomy eyes wide.
You bet. Can't have you dying before I bring you in. Wouldn't look good on my resume.
He placed the injector against James's neck and pressed, the needle distributing healing cells into the large man.
How did you make it this far?
I had antibiotics and a shot of adrenaline. I found them in Creston,
the man said, staring at the ground. He rubbed his neck at the injection site and was already looking better. Dex glanced to the cloth over the man's bloody stump and knew they'd have to clean it soon if they made it out of the forest alive.
Go on with the story, Dex grunted.
James cleared his throat, his wheezing all but gone. His footsteps were faster, sure of themselves, and Dex knew the shot was doing its magic.
I was brought in with everyone else at the start. Cattle herd lines. I saw at least 100 people shot down or torn apart by what we call trackers now. Back then, they were only terrifying robot dogs. People were turning on people. Everyone was crying, children screaming. I remember seeing them for the first time. Three of them walked the line of us. They were so tall, thin but muscular. I heard them talk to one another. Clicks, I'll never forget that. I could smell them as they strolled by, as casually as if they were on the beach on vacation. They smelled like a tannery.
Dex scrunched up his face. He knew exactly what the guy was talking about.
I remember visiting one when I was a kid in school. I've smelled them too, unfortunately.
Dex had been face to face with them too many times to count. Each one he worried would be his last.
That's right. Anyway, they went by me, not so much as glancing at the line. Some guy, brave or foolish, tried to attack one of the three. The overseer grabbed his neck, lifted the guy, and snapped him like a twig, dropping his body to the ground. They kept moving, clicking away in conversation. I knew we were screwed at that moment. I've never told anyone this before, but I wet my pants then.
James was moving faster, and Dex had to hurry to catch up. It was dark now. The last of the sunlight sunk beyond the horizon, and Dex hoped they could make it back without needing to use his lights. The Seekers could always tell where he was by his ID, but drawing extra attention was never a good idea. Dex remembered the lines well himself. He'd stood in them with his parents. They took his mom first. His dad had gone maniacal trying to fight for her. The shot from the tracker had been fast and efficient. Teenage Dex hadn't known where it came from until he saw the line of smoke from the robotic four-legged creature's attached weaponry. Dex had noticed it wasn't going to go after the female woman being dragged away, and it turned, scanning the rest of the crowd. Dex was left with his dad, convulsing on the ground beside him, until he stopped moving completely. Dex had gone into the camp that night covered in blood and had made a vow. Now, as he blindly worked his way through the forest, he hated himself for what he'd become. He spat on the ground and kept moving.
"I won't tell anyone about your accident,"
Dex said, getting a nervous chuckle from the other man.
"Sure, like it matters. Are they going to kill me?"
he asked. Dex uttered a grunt. It meant he didn't know.
"Not if you're important enough. Keep talking."
"I majored in accounting, but I had a mind for logistics. I was thinking of getting into that field instead, but my dad..."
James paused.
"Not that any of that mattered after they came, so here I am."
He gave a depreciative one-handed shrug.
"I worked for them in a warehouse for 10 years and became a supervisor."
Interesting. A supervisor meant he was in charge of people. Humans. The workers always hated the supervisors. They all thought they'd sold out working for the overseers like lackeys. Dex wondered if the roamer was trying to pull a fast one on him.
"I started to make changes and suggesting things that improved flow. I had the warehouse running so smoothly that they only needed half the workers,"
James explained guiltily, and Dex didn't need to ask what had happened to those they didn't need. They were either killed or transferred to some other menial task.
"One of them came to meet with me. He had a human with him, a middle-aged woman. She was smart. She and I talked about the system they were operating on, which was their own homegrown software from wherever the hell they came from. It might have worked for them, but on Earth it didn't make a lot of sense. I spoke my mind and was lucky to live through the day. I know that now, but back then, I thought they needed me more than I needed them. She whispered something to me I'll never forget. When the overseer was out of range, she smelled wonderful, like flowers in the spring. Her chest pressed against my shoulder, her breath hot and sweet."
James's voice was light and wistful. Dex was right beside the man, and he pulled out his tablet, seeing the icon for his car up ahead a mile or so away. Close, they were close.
"Well, what did she say?"
"She said, 'You don't know what you've done. You're helping strengthen their foothold.' And then she was off, smiling at me like nothing happened. She walked away beside the towering alien, her heels clicking down the hallway, sounding like its clipped speech."
James stumbled again, and Dex was there to catch him.
"What did she mean?"
Dex asked, playing dumb.
"This was 10 years in. People still had hope we could come back from all of this. That's what she meant. She actually thought we had a chance of fighting back. You know the funny thing?"
he asked.
"What?"
"I didn't for a minute consider the possibility that we could rise above this oppression. Not for a damned second. Even after this woman, clearly working for them, directly told me those words, I still didn't believe it. So I did what anyone in my position would do. I created the logistics program that optimized the running of supplies from breeding grounds to camps to manufacturing plants. I controlled which truck went where and what they took with them. They treated me like a king."
He motioned to his belly, which, unlike most of the human population, was well fed.
"I had women, my own home with staff. I had it all."
Dex was confused by one thing.
"If you were so shit hot, why are you here walking in the forest with your hand missing?"
James paused, and Dex had to give him a light shove to keep walking.
"I don't know, to be honest. I woke up one day, and it was as if a veil was lifted from my mind. I saw the way the staff stared at me, like they wanted to kill me. I saw the shipments for one of the breeding grounds, and I actually thought about what they were doing to us, as a people. I hadn't been to one of those grounds before, have you?
Dex didn't want this to be about him. He'd seen the atrocities the overseers brought on them, but this runt didn't need to know his story. He just grunted, and James continued.
It's sick. Their entire operation is horrifying, and I realized that I'd been part of it. That woman had been right. I helped them. I spent 15 years improving their processes. I mean, what the actual hell had I been thinking? I thought about killing myself, but that wouldn't atone for my sins.
Dex felt his blood pumping quickly, like he was about to hear something he shouldn't. He hoped the trackers weren't close by and that the seekers weren't hovering above them, recording their conversation. Dex and his target were close to his car. Half a mile and they were free. He could bring the prize home, then he'd be off to the isolated lake house for a week. He needed it. Dex thought about a roaring fire in the fireplace, the whiskey he'd left in Creston, and the stale cigarettes. He also had a couple books he hadn't gotten through, and he was ready to be done with this one so he could enjoy the brief respite.
What did you do? Dex asked.
I screwed with the program.
How?
Moved some people around.
James glanced at Dex with the corner of his eye, his mouth opening slightly like he wanted to add to it, then his lips sealed tightly.
Interesting. Anything else?
Dex asked, finding that he did want to know, not so he could share it with the overseers, more out of curiosity. A dormant section of his brain wanted to see the aliens receive retaliation. He always did his part, in tiny ways, taking an extra day to answer their requests, doubling rations when he shouldn't, just to test them. So far, no one seemed to care, and that was when he realized no one did. They were there for more than human interaction, but until this moment, Dex hadn't thought about what that might be. They'd been there for 25 years, and nothing had really changed since the first few years. Dex knew of 27 manufacturing facilities in the United States alone and imagined there would be hundreds around the world. What were they doing in China where the infrastructure would be massive? James hadn't answered him.
Anything else?
Dex pushed.
I caused problems they will be dealing with for months, let's put it that way,
James said with what sounded like a smirk of satisfaction in his voice.
Will they make you fix it?
Dex asked. This guy might be one of the few the overseers wanted caught so they could keep him working. He was sure the rest of the roamers he brought in were killed, and not pleasantly. They usually killed the returning roamers in front of other workers to make a point. Dex had witnessed it a few times with rogue hunters. He could still see Daphne's weather-worn face as her throat was cut outside the Columbus facility. The five hunters stationed there had to dig the grave and clean the stains when it was done.
I suspect they will, James said.
Dex wasn't so sure. There had to be others in the aliens' network that would understand the system Trent James had built. The whining of a seeker drone startled him. He was a hunter of roamers, and that was what he did to survive. Nothing else mattered. His gun was up and he scanned the treetops, but in the darkness he couldn't find the source of the noise. Then he heard it. Mechanical legs were pounding the forest floor, twigs snapping wildly.
Run!
Dex shouted, pushing James forward. The road was only 100 yards away, and Dex fumbled for his keys as they ran. He had them in his left hand when James stumbled and fell hard, skidding to a stop at the base of a pine tree. Dex grabbed at the man, but he was groaning, injured.
It had taken all his energy to make the miles-long hike back to the car, and the roamer was at his end.
"Shit!"
Dex shouted, kicking the ground. He considered running for his car and getting out of there without James. He could let the tracker notify the powers that be about his whereabouts.
"Help me,"
Trent James whispered, and Dex saw his eyes blink open. They were wide, staring at something behind Dex. He pulled the man up and saw his car between the trees a short distance away. They could make it. A bullet blasted into the tree beside Dex, and his heart leapt into his throat. The tracker had found them.
"This is my target. I'm Dexter Lambert," he said his full name, hating the tracker for making him recall his parents' surname at that moment. He wanted to make it pay. "This is Trent James, and he's in my custody," he was yelling, unable to lower his worked-up voice.
Dex shouted his ID badge number out for the seeker and tracker to hear, even though he knew they could scan him.
"Your masters want this man alive. It's in his file."
The sound of the seeker grew louder as it lowered from above the tree canopy. It hung in the air 20 feet up, directly between the tracker and Dex. The tracker watched him with glowing red eyes, its head tilting in animal mimicry. He wondered if they were always programmed like that, or if it was something the aliens changed to make the robots feel more familiar to humans. He wished the trackers would speak to him. He knew they were intelligent, almost as if they were organic creatures. They learned and adapted, and it made them formidable foes. It was why Dex was glad they were on the same side. Right now, he wasn't so sure they were. It walked closer, moving on all fours. One of its guns had protruded from its back, and Dex was sweating as the muzzle of the high-powered weapon pointed toward him and James behind him.
"I thought they wanted you alive," Dex muttered through closed teeth.
"So did I,"
James grunted. He was bleeding from the lip, and the cloth over his stump had turned red again, dripping slowly on a pile of dead leaves by his feet.
"If I don't make it, you have to do something. I can see you want to make a difference. There are others."
Dex's blood went cold. Why was this man telling him this? He worked for the Overseers. He was only there to look out for himself, and he'd continued to do that.
"Don't bother,"
Dex warned him, but it was too late.
"Omaha, University of Nebraska, Science Hall, Locker 31 Alpha 010927, combination. Got it?"
The man's voice was hardly audible.
"Locker 31 A010927. You'll find all you need there."
"Shut up,"
Dex said.
"Just shut up."
The tracker was coming closer, slow, tentative steps.
"This man is under my custody. Stop where you are and let me detain the target and take him to my car."
Behind him, James was still whispering the locker number and combination. The tracker was close, barely 10 yards away. It looked larger than before, and Dex had rarely seen them from this angle. They usually remained in the distance, watching.
"University of Nebraska."
The words were so quiet, a gasp of a man knowing he's on his way out. Dex glanced down and saw blood pooling beside James's leg. His stump had clearly opened up, and if he didn't receive help right away, he was going to die.
"I need to get you some help,"
Dex said, stepping to the side. The blast was instantaneous. James's head exploded, and pieces of the man splattered across Dex's jacket and face. He wanted to scream, but couldn't find the air. James was dead, and the proof was covering Dex. He wiped his face with the sleeve of his leather jacket and glanced at the corpse beside him. His ears rang from the loud shot, and he looked to see the tracker was already gone. With a quick scan in the air, Dex saw the seeker drone had departed as well. His back pressed against the large tree trunk,
He had some seriously inside information now, something that might help fight the aliens and drones. In his startled state, he didn't know what to do with the dead man's last words.
9. Cole.
Cole walked through the abandoned rooms, seeing dust-covered glass cases showing what the place looked like long ago. He read the small plaques of a time estimated to be more than 200 years before his shelter was a reinforced position in a war between America and Mexico. He couldn't understand why humans would fight against each other. The concept of killing another person over land or resources wasn't completely removed from his reality, as he'd suffered confrontations with other groups more than a few times in his life, but he found the idea of actually being at war with his own kind bizarre. He guessed they didn't have the aliens or human collaborators to contend with. If they had, he was sure they'd see eye to eye and turn their old guns on the shiny drones and hovercraft. Turning his mind to more immediate issues, he set to work digging loose the heavy glass covering the water well preserved as a museum piece. Cole had been taught about museums, but hadn't been inside one before. Preserving the past seemed pointless, however, seeing as humans were unable to preserve their present. Cole didn't imagine they had much of a future, either. Everything he knew of the history of his people was that they were either too busy destroying the planet or each other to pay much attention to what was going on around them. He guessed that was probably why the world was the way it was by the time he was born. He used the small crowbar from his pack, breaking away the crumbled mortar from the edges of the glass cover, before forcing the edge of the tool underneath it and standing on it to use all of his weight on the lever. It took him a while, most of the morning, and eventually he'd shifted it enough to create a gap large enough to stick his arms into. Cole sat back, breathing hard after the exertion, as he tossed a fist-sized stone into the dark hole. It took a couple of seconds to reach the water, making him take an involuntary shuffle away from the edge. He pulled the bundles of twine from his pack, carefully connecting each end to the next piece with secure knots, before going off in search of something to gather the precious fluid. Another room yielded large plastic bottles, which he tediously adapted to work as pails. Ultimately, lowering his creation into the dark abyss, he felt the weight of it fall away when it hit the surface of the water. He left it there for a while, until the distant hint of bubbles faded to nothing, pulling gently on the cord to return it to the surface. He lifted it up and over, cautious not to catch it on the stone lip, and made a celebratory noise as he saw two bottles containing clear liquid. He dipped his finger in one, licking the water and finding it crisp and cool with no trace of salt or chemicals. He filled all of his containers, bringing up another yield to drink until he couldn't drink any more. He went outside, assessing the low walls and seeing the obvious animal tracks of the small creatures that called this place part of their home. He went to the biggest, where the deeper impressions indicated a four-legged animal of a good size, and rigged a pair of wire snares into the gap in the wall where the animal entered to follow whatever patrol routine it lived by. The snares were looped above a high metal frame nearby, twice the height of a man, so that anything activating the traps would drop into the lower ground inside the wall and hopefully suspend itself. He felt no sadness in taking the life of the abundant animals in the world he lived in, but he took no pleasure in killing anything except drones, which came as naturally as breathing. After making a fire in the corner of one room, he stretched out on what had once been a comfortable couch, then closed his eyes and slept. A sharp twang and the hiss of fast-moving wire woke him. His eyes went instantly wide, even as his body hadn't moved a millimeter, but he quickly scrabbled to his feet. He ran for the sprung trap the second he realized that whatever had triggered it wasn't dead or dying. The whining, snarling sound was a mixture of desperation and fear and the promise of violent retribution. He had to stop it from making such a racket, and quickly. Sound carried at night, even more than in the daytime. Something about the stillness of the air and the lack of ambient noise caused by the various wildlife being tucked up somewhere safe. Sleeping with his boots on had been the habit of a lifetime for exactly this kind of scenario. He snatched up the shotgun even though he had no intention of using it, transferring the gun to his left hand as he ran towards the source of the noise and silently slid the long blade from the leather sheath on his belt. In the last dying light of the long day, he saw what had triggered his snares and was hit by a number of emotions all at once. The shaggy-coated coyote was caught by one back leg, and instead of the other snare tightening around the animal's throat, it had caught it by the upper jaw. The pained predator thrashed and whined in anguish. He wasted no time. He stepped as close as he could safely and held the blade ready to slide it to the hilt in between the coyote's ribs. Only he stopped before he could bring himself to make the thrust. The animal ceased fighting, instead lying still and whimpering as it stared at him with one wide eye. Cole felt a connection to the animal then, not a sense of them being on the same side by any stretch of the imagination, more that they were both just trying to survive in the same screwed-up world. Neither of them had asked for this, but both were forced to rely on their own cunning, or they would simply die. Cole shook himself out of the locked gaze and quickly pulled down the snares to let the coyote rest on the earth. He circled it carefully, not entirely sure what he was doing, and clutched the knife in his hand in case it didn't want to let him help. Knowing he might end up bitten and that an infected bite could mean his death, he reached tentatively towards the snare wrapped tightly on the animal's rear leg. Fully prepared to use the knife if his life was in danger, but wanting to try and save the animal if he could. A low growl came as his fingers brushed the thick coat, and the animal jolted from his touch like it was electric, but it didn't move as he deftly removed the wire loop. Blood showed through its coat, making him worry that the leg had broken and his attempts to save it were doomed. The trap wrapped around the thing's top jaw, curling the lip up to show sharp teeth and underline the fear coming off of it in waves, was much harder to remove safely. Cole started from the other end, trying to take the pressure out of it by manipulating the wire without effect, until it suddenly came loose and the coyote thrashed and used its front paws to drag the wire from its mouth. It lay there, panting, watching him, with blood dripping from its tongue. And he suddenly felt ashamed of himself. He'd set the trap for the trackers, which he hoped wouldn't be coming, but also in the hopes that he could snare something he could eat. Finding himself looking at enough meat to sustain him for a few weeks, he felt no desire to hurt the animal any more than he already had, and realized that he had to atone for what he'd already done somehow. Reaching into his pocket for a scrap of his dried meat, Cole leaned closer to offer it towards the wounded animal and froze when it issued a rumbling growl from deep in its throat. The snarl stopped and its nose twitched at the scent of food. The confusion lasted for a second more before the growl returned, and he tossed the scrap of tough meat towards the animal for it to sniff and cautiously pick up with a long, bloody tongue. He left a trail of jerky towards an empty storeroom where he poured fresh well water into a dish and went to reset the snares with loops too small to repeat the mistake before returning to sleep behind a firmly closed door. 10. Alec. Alec was sweating profusely. The summer had finally hit the region with a vengeance. Why today? Why couldn't the heat have waited until whatever was going to happen was over? He worked tirelessly on the welding job, holding sheets of metal, riveting corners and edges, while someone else came to weld seams together in a never-ending process. The shift had started almost 4 hours ago, and it had to be close to 11. Noon would mark a 15-minute break, and Alec hoped he'd be able to hide the handoff. Crash and Jackfish were working on the other side of the facility's open room where their section of the curtained structure lay. Alec watched from the corner of his eye as human guards entered the room, motioning the workers to the side as they fully covered the metal-walled contraption. Alec had absolutely no idea what lay behind the curtains and doubted he ever would. If he made it through today alive, he would be running away that night. He'd find a way to sneak Beth out, too. Sure, they'd be on the lam for a while, but there were ways to get an ID tracker out. He glanced to his own wrist, rotating his hand while he contemplated cutting the ID tag out of his own arm and giving Beth the bracelet that muted the signal. Beth was on the far edge of the manufacturing floor, a tablet in her hand as she strolled down the line, checking to